This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. We hear it so often, it's become a mantra. New Hampshire is a great place to raise kids. And for most children, that is indeed the case, at least measured by standard indicators of child well-being, factors like family income, access to health care, decent housing, and healthy food. Still, some Granite State families struggle and are struggling even more than in the past. 11% of New Hampshire kids today live in poverty, compared to 6% a decade and a half ago. And the percentage of Granite State children who now live in single-parent households has gone up over the years as well, to 28%. This week, NHPR and The Exchange will be examining these trends as they affect the youngest kids in a series we're calling The First Decade. Today in The Exchange, we begin with the numbers, changing family demographics, dynamics, and incomes, and how they're shaping the youngest members of our society. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests in the studio. With us is Stephanie Emmons, Early Childhood Specialist with Child and Family Services of New Hampshire. Stephanie, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us, Kristen Smith, Family Demographer with the Carsey School of Public Policy at UNH. And Kristen, thank you for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And also with us, Ellen Feinberg, Executive Director of New Hampshire Kids Count. She's got a lot of data on children here in the Granite State. And Ellen will be digging into some of that this hour. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, and I did want to start with you, Ellen. You know, we're talking about the youngest Granite Staters this week, zero to 10. What do kids look like today if you had a group of 5-year-olds or a group of 10-year-olds versus that same group a generation ago, say 25 or 30 years ago? What would be different about today's group versus that earlier group?
Well, let me just start out by saying how many children we have under the age of 18 in New Hampshire, so, and how that they're now about 20% of our population, whereas a decade ago or 15 years ago, there were 25% of our children were in that age group. So that age population is shrinking.
There's fewer of them. We've heard a lot about that.
That's right. And we've all heard about the growing number of people who are over 65 in our population. But there are about 271,000 kids in our state. Most of them live in the southern part of the state, like the rest of us. And most the larger child populations are in Nashua and Manchester. Most of those children are still white, and that's about 91%. But there's a growing Hispanic number of children in our state. They make up about 5%. And then 2% of the students in our schools have limited English proficiency. And I know you've heard about this. Most of those children, almost 40%, are in the Manchester schools. So that just gives you some idea of what the population looks like. And you talked about poverty numbers. So for what do we mean when we say that we have children living in poverty?
Right. What does that mean?
Right. So that measure, the federal measure of poverty, looks at a family of four, two adults, two kids, with earning less than $24,000 a year. The highest rate of poverty, which most people think of as the most important measure, is in Coos County, but not necessarily the best measure, because the higher numbers of families living in poverty really live in the southern part of the state where there's more population.
So if we had that group of, you know, kindergartners, let's say, and there's 20 kids, you know, and you always get those class pictures, you
right,
know, and you
exactly.
see the kids and they're so adorable. So let's say that somebody took that picture in 2015 and somebody took that picture in 1995. It sounds like the 2015 picture would be more diverse racially. Maybe more kids in that 2015 class would come from single-parent households. Maybe more would be living in poverty. What would it be, Ellen?
Well, I think it really depends where that family lives in our state. Geography has so much to do with the way that our state looks. There are still, you know, we have changing demographics in different parts of our state. And so we do know that those that classroom picture would have fewer kids in it than the picture that was taken a while ago.
I'd love to hear from you, too, on this, Kristen. If you could compare those two kindergarten classes for me, and what would be different?
Well, one thing that would be different is the proportionate kids who have been in daycare, you know, full-time daycare before they come into school, into kindergarten. So one thing we're seeing is there's more children than 20 years ago who are engaged in the school readiness, the daycare centers. And we see that, you know, some of the kids are coming to school prepared for school in terms of socialization and literacy and reading. But then we do still have a number of children who are not going to daycare centers. They're not engaging in those school readiness programs. And so we're seeing sort of a widening gap between those children who are ready for school and those children who are not.
So we're seeing more kids coming from homes where both mom and dad are working, and so the kids are in daycare.
Right. Yeah. That, I mean, that's usually the primary reason that children are in daycare. Full-time organized daycare is because both parents are working. However, there are a growing number of parents who use childcare as an enrichment and a school readiness.
Yeah, is that necessarily a bad thing? I mean, more kids being in daycare? Or is that can we even pass a judgment, a value judgment on that?
No, I don't think we can really pass a judgment on that. I think that different daycares have different quality, that they're, you know, different daycares have different things that they're focused on. And, you know, some daycares are wonderful. They're really good experiences for children. And those children come out of that prepared. And then other daycares, you know, may or may not have that same quality that those children are engaging in.
Okay. And Stephanie, I haven't forgotten about you, but I also want to remind our listeners that you can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Today in the Exchange, we're kicking off a week-long series we're calling The First Decade, looking at the youngest Granite Staters. And this hour, we're looking at some of the changing demographics concerning our kids. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. What changes have you noticed here in New Hampshire in terms of family demographics, dynamics, income levels? Again, you can join us 1-800-892-6477. You know, Stephanie, we talked about some of the kids that are struggling, and Ellen gave us a good picture of the data. What are some of the struggles that you see in the families that you work with in terms of, again, these little kids under 10?
Sure. We see parents who are struggling financially. Also, a lot of stressors in the home, homelessness, substance abuse. So that really impacts the children early in their in the early years. So with those multiple stressors, you may see more behaviors in the children, maybe more acting out behaviors, some anxiety, some, you know, general fears, because they're just going through so much, that instability in the home.
And then it becomes sort of a negative spiral, doesn't it?
Sure, yeah.
Because you act out in school and then you get in trouble.
Exactly.
And
it's really not,
yeah.
I think it's hard too, because it's not necessarily knowing where those behaviors are coming from. So when we go in and we work with families, it's trying to eliminate those or try to reduce those stressors to try to, and then focus on different interventions that can help to kind of, I guess, control or better manage those behaviors.
And I know you can't give, you know, specific names and situations on the air, Stephanie, obviously, but can you give us just a for instance of some of the typical things that would be happening in a family that would bring you into the situation?
Sure. It really could be anything. We get referrals from hospitals, schools, different community agencies. So it could just be parents who are struggling with their children's behaviors, but then also finding out that they're having trouble getting connected in the community, either for mental health services, really just a variety of different resources that they're in need of. So we help to get them connected. And then also look if they're having behaviors with having trouble with their children's behaviors. But really it's focusing on those basic needs first, because it's really hard to get to those other issues if, you know, basic needs aren't met.
So if a kid is acting out in school, he gets in trouble, he gets suspended, maybe it's because he's homeless, or his parents are getting a divorce,
exactly,
or he's hungry, or so that's the kind of stuff that you're mm-hmm. you're digging into.
And we help to advocate too, because a lot of families really struggle. There's a lack of confidence, and so when our workers go in, it's trying to support with advocacy and really also in the school system, kind of saying, hey, this is what's going on with this family, and maybe this is why this child is acting out in this way.
Again, our phone number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So as we get into some of the struggles that families are facing, and again, New Hampshire is a great place to raise kids. We have one of the lowest poverty rate, I think, in the nation. That's often mentioned, and it should be. But I think to you, Ellen, New Hampshire's poverty rate, we looked at it this morning, the lowest in the nation. But our child poverty rate is higher. So 8.7% poverty rate for New Hampshire, 11% child poverty rate. Why is it higher?
I think that this population that my fellow speakers today have been talking about, these young families often have higher poverty rates than as children get older. And that is often because those women or men, and there are about 28% of the families, have only one parent at home. Of those, 20% are headed by women and 8% are headed by males. So that that population often has difficulty getting the right kind of childcare and other support so they can be out in the workplace. And those children are not in school yet unless they have the ability to go to one of those daycare programs that Kristen was talking about, or an early learning situation. And so getting that support into the home where the parent can go out and work is often creates a situation where the parent cannot go out into the workplace and have adequate care for kids. And so that creates problems with economic well-being.
So somebody might want to get out and work.
Absolutely.
But he or she
Absolutely.
Has a two-year-old at home. So, all right. We'll follow up on that after a short break. And I know you have some things to say about that too, Kristen. The exchange number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the first in our week-long series called The First Decade, we're looking at trends in family economics and demographics and the stories behind them as to how they affect the youngest Granite Staters, those aged 0 to 10. 1-800-892-6477. As we talk about some of the struggles that some Granite State families have with that higher child poverty rate, is this an issue that touches you personally? Or even if it doesn't affect you, what do you see in your community in terms of young child poverty? What do you think causes it? What do you think might help people get out of it? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. My guests are Stephanie Emmons, Early Childhood Specialist with Child and Family Services of New Hampshire, Ellen Feinberg, Executive Director of New Hampshire Kids Count, and Kristen Smith, Family Demographer with the Carsey School of Public Policy at UNH. And all of you, let's go to our listeners. And first up is Kate in Bellows Falls, Vermont. Hi, Kate. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling. Okay, Kate, we lost you. We hope you call back. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Kristen, just before the break, I was asking Ellen why our child poverty rate is higher than our overall poverty rate. And she made the point, which seems pretty obvious, that if you've got kids, it's sometimes harder to get out and get that job. This all is tied into access to affordable childcare, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I just wanted to add to what Ellen was saying about access to child care. There's three things that are part of the access. One is geographic. So in rural areas, there's just less child care available. And in our state, which is a rural state, you know, we have that issue for families who are living in more remote areas. But there's also the financial accessibility. So, you know, child care is an expense for families. And for families that are low-income families, they're paying upwards of one-third, 32% of their total family income goes to child care. Compare that to a higher income family, it's only 8%.
So do they make the calculation that it's just not worth it?
Well, so they do different things. They seek child care subsidies. That's one way of doing, you know, of reducing their child care costs. But then they also will look for other less expensive child care options. And so they may rely on grandparents. They may rely on relatives. They may rely on a neighbor that charges less. The third thing that overlaps all of that is the quality of child care. And so if you wanted to purchase high quality child care, you're going to be paying a lot more. So when you overlap all of that for low income families, you know, that's where you see that child care, you know, access to high quality child care is very difficult for low income families.
And how do you define high quality? Because that's a little touchy, right? I mean, your neighbor may be wonderful with kids.
Right. And there are, you know, measures that researchers use that they go into different child care settings, and they have things like child to teacher ratio. They look at other types of things. And, you know, you're right. It could be that the neighbor down the road is a wonderful child care provider. But overall, children typically do better in sort of the organized child care arrangements in terms of school readiness and socialization.
School readiness, meaning they at least recognize the
alphabet
and the numbers
and
all
numbers.
That stuff.
Yeah.
And I do wonder, you know, if you're in a home situation, if there's some sort of parking in front of the TV, because you're busy.
Right.
You're trying to get stuff done and so forth. So it's a tricky situation. Go ahead, Stephanie. I'd love to hear from you on that as well.
Sure. I mean, I think that what we see, too, is young moms who are looking to get employment and they don't have child care. So it's hard because until they can get child care, how do they get out and actually go and look for work? Because then they have to find. And then to me, that goes back to one of those stressors where trying to figure out day to day, who's going to watch my child? How am I going to find work? And then when they do find work, we've actually run into some moms that they can't make over a certain amount because then they'll lose their child care subsidy, which then is also really concerning and frustrating. So they have to maintain a certain income. So
explain that a little bit more, because some people might not understand that. What you just said about if you make too much, you lose your subsidy, which makes sense because the subsidies are for very low income people. But there's probably a scratchy line there.
Sure.
Do you want to jump in on that,
Stephanie,
or Kristen? Yeah, go ahead.
Sure, I can jump in with that. So child care subsidies, in our state, we have different income levels that you can get a subsidy at. And if you have a job and you qualify for subsidies, you may get a raise in that job that would put you over that line, and therefore you would lose your subsidy. So that's what she was talking about.
Go ahead. Yeah, Ellen.
And the issue about that, and please both of you chime in as well, is that it's you're not making that much more that you really can afford to now take on the whole cost of the child care yourself. And so you're sort of darned if you do and darned if you don't, because you want to be out there working. And you're thrilled that you've gotten this raise, but now you don't really quite have enough money to make things work.
Absolutely. You may have to stop using the child care arrangement that you have because you can't afford what the difference between the subsidy is and the amount that you would have to pay, because your raise hasn't really gotten you that much ahead. It may be, you know, a small raise, but the cost that you would have to pay would be too big for you to be able to make that payment.
Again, our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, we're looking at the first decade for children in the Granite State. And this hour, we're crunching some of the numbers around family incomes, demographics, changing family setups. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Again, email is exchange at nhpr.org. So I want to pick up on something that all of you have mentioned, and that's single moms. And just to repeat, Ellen, you said earlier that 28% of Granite State kids today grow up in single-parent households. What were the particular challenges around that? I mean, nobody's, you know, piling onto these single parents. They're doing the best they can, probably, but what are the challenges?
Well, we've talked about some of those challenges in terms of childcare and being able to juggle all the responsibilities of being a parent, which is challenging when you have two adults in a household, and never mind when you're trying to do it yourself, especially if you have more than one child. And especially if you have economic challenges that may require you to use public transportation, which we know there's not enough public transportation in many parts of our state, when you need to put food on the table, and in some places there are grocery stores that are very far from where you live, and so that may be a challenge also. There are multiple kinds of challenges that these families have. One of the interesting pieces to look at is that the subsidies that we have to help families through these periods of time when they have these issues, and relatively, families only stay on these subsidy programs for less than 2 years. And usually it's during these difficult times.
Are you talking about child care subsidies?
Well, child care, food stamps, housing vouchers, all of those kinds of subsidies. There was a report that came out last year that said that without those subsidies in our state, there would be an additional 25,000 children who would slip below the poverty line. So that would mean we'd have 55,000 children who are living in families with an income level that's very low. So these subsidies really do help, and they make a difference whether they're single-parent families or two-income parent families. But as we know, the incomes in our state have never quite gotten back to where they were before that recession. People may have jobs, but they're not earning as much.
Yeah, I definitely have another couple questions for you on that, Ellen. But I want to bring the two of you also in on this issue of single moms. And correct me if I'm wrong, Ellen, you said most single parent households are moms. What were the numbers there again?
Yes, 20% of the 28% who are living in single family are moms, and 8% or dads.
Run by dads. What do you see, Stephanie, in particular of these single parent households, moms and dads? What are some of the particular issues that you work with on that?
Sure. I mean, when you're talking, there's actually a mom that pops into my mind where she was fleeing a domestic violence relationship. I think that that's something that happens often. And then just trying, you know, juggling with three children. I agree with what Ellen's saying, where trying to, you know, even access transportation, like public transportation with three small children, trying to access any resources, it just makes it really difficult. It's difficult enough being a parent and having someone to support you, that other, you know, parental figure. But then when you're on your own and you find yourself with no place to go, being locked out of your apartment with your three children, I mean, with no real support. I mean, that's when we have some families who reach out to us and they ask for help.
Well, and we do hear nationally, too, that, you know, most single-parent households are run by moms, although there are dads. But for these single-mom households, where are the dads? I mean, is it just, are they in jail? Or is it divorce? Is the dad involved at all? I mean, I know you can't make a broad sweep, but why so many run by moms?
I mean, the mom that I'm thinking of in particular, Dow is incarcerated for domestic violence. But I think it varies. It's hard to kind of say specific. I think some dads are just MIA and we don't know, you know, moms don't know. I think that sometimes it could be incarceration. So
a variety of situations,
sure.
I'm sure that you run into. And so here's the quick question for you, Kristen, since you're a researcher. When we define a single parent household, let's say the parents are divorced and they split custody, does that count? Because, you know, at any particular point in time, yes, that child is going home to only one parent, but he or she still has two parents engaged and involved. So I just wonder how you define that.
That is a great question. And so a lot of our data that we're citing is based on household surveys. So it's not looking at custody. It's looking at who is living in the household with the parent. So single parent families are defined by their living arrangement. So you may have there may be joint custody, but they're still defined as a single parent. And, you know, one of the really difficult things to measure is those children that go back and forth between families, 1 week with this parent, 1 week with the next parent. Those are very hard for these surveys to define, because it's looking at right now where are they living
at
right
that
now?
One yeah. point in time. Yeah.
yeah. And so, you know, sometimes our society changes before our surveys catch up.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there are efforts to look at those things and make those things, those questions better at capturing specific things. But right now it's household living arrangements. I just wanted to chime in on the single parents and some of the job flexibility issues that are facing single parents. So we know that single parents typically have lower earnings, not all of them, but, you know.
You only have one income coming
right,
in.
Right, so there's lower earnings, and a lot of those jobs don't have paid sick time, job flexibility, time off, those vacation days. And so that makes it more difficult for families to arrange these things when a child gets sick or a snow day, for example. You know, how does a single parent work within those kinds of constraints that they have in the job market?
You know, I know it's hard to say about any particular situation, but it is interesting, and it would be good for researchers like yourself, Kristen, to get that kind of data of, you know, I know so many kids whose parents are divorced. So, yes, you know, 3 days a week they're with mom and 3 days a week they're with dad, but they're not really that struggling
That's
single
right.
mom family that Stephanie described, where she's got three little kids, she's on her own. You know, these kids are well supported by both parents. You know, it's not ideal for them, but it's working.
Yes, you've given me a good research idea.
Yeah. You have to get to the Census Bureau on that. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, we're just digging into some of the data surrounding changing family dynamics here in the Granite State as part of our series, The First Decade, looking at kids in New Hampshire from ages 0 to 10. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. And here's an email from Susie that just came in. She says, I keep hearing from your guests this idea that organized childcare is necessary for kids to be ready for school. Susie says, I think this is ridiculous. I'm a stay-at-home mom, which I do recognize is rare these days, and my daughter was never in regular childcare. She was very ready to start school. I did not park her in front of the TV. I took her to the library, to the park. I colored with her and played with her. Susie says, I know many families simply can't have a parent at home, but to go to the opposite extreme and say that daycare is always necessary for readiness is a mistake. Kristen, I don't think you were saying that per se, but for those kids who do have to be in daycare. But go ahead. Thank you, Susie, very much.
Thank you, Susie, because I didn't mean to imply that daycare centers are, you know, the best, and that that's the only situation for children to make them ready for school. And if I did make if that's how you interpret it, I apologize, because that was not my intent. We're really focusing here on low-income single parents. And, you know, in that situation where there is a need for childcare, an organized childcare center has been shown in research that, you know, they do better in those organized settings. But I have many acquaintances who have stayed home with their children and have, you know, been able to have this very enriching environment for their children.
All right. Well, Susie, thank you for the email. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. One more question for you, Ellen, on, again, these single-parent families, and maybe for you too, Stephanie. We've been talking a lot about, you know, the individual struggle for the mom or the dad and the kids. What about broadly, societally? You know, it's easy to say, yeah, that's too bad, but it's not really my problem.
Well, I think that this whole conversation really talks about the fact that this is really systemic. It's not an individual problem. I mean, yes, it comes down to that on the day-to-day basis, but what we really need to be looking at is how we can help lift up both parents and kids together, and to create a different way of doing business, not only in our state but in our country, around raising kids. And to be able to provide as a society for all of our kids so that we have the kind of future in our country that we fondly look at and think about, gee, that's what it was like in the old days, whatever that means to whoever it was. The other piece we haven't really talked about here is the issue of race, and that in our state there's a growing diversity, as there is across the United States, and that the opportunities available for some children differ from those of other kids. And we need to make sure that we're leveling the playing field, urban, rural, black, white, and in many other ways.
Well, and this gets to a quote from your Kids Count report. You say, Ellen, that research shows that living in poverty, even for a short time, has long-term negative cognitive, physical, and economic effects for both children and adults. So cognitive effects, just give us a little bit more there, please. What are the cognitive effects of growing up poor?
We know that there's something called toxic stress. If you're living in these kinds of difficult situations, not enough to eat, the anxiety and stress of the parent, and maybe homeless and having to move around, being in situations where, as has been described, we have a mother who's with three kids trying to juggle all of that. Kids pick up on all of those kinds of situations, and they feel traumatized, especially if you're moving around a lot. And so that lack of stability often impacts kids whose brains are rapidly developing as young children and creates what's called toxic stress.
Okay, and after a short break, Stephanie, I'll ask you about some of the things you've seen for sure in your work with families. You can join us, too. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at life for the youngest kids in the Granite State. Part of our series we're kicking off this week called The First Decade. This hour, we're examining the evolving picture of families in New Hampshire, including the rise of single-parent households. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And all of you, just before the break, Ellen Feinberg was talking about toxic stress and how, you know, living in poverty, when you're a young child in particular, your brain is developing and there's all sorts of negative outcomes down the line for you, including your brain development. What about that? What do you see, Stephanie, in terms of toxic stress and how it affects just the emotional and intellectual development that is supposed to go on?
Sure. I think that goes back to what I was saying earlier about maybe seeing kids in school and seeing some problematic behaviors or some anxiety, that research is now coming out and saying that these early experiences in children, that they matter, that they do impact brain development, and that we're seeing the, like, as they get older, like, that impact. And I know we were talking about, like, cognitively and social emotionally, like, maybe not being able to manage different situations with that toxic stress, like being so hypersensitized that something that you might be like, oh, that's not a big deal, for another kid is very problematic, and that, you know, they their whole body just gets so tense, and they're, you know, it's, they almost go into that fight or flight response. So we are seeing that, you know, I think sometimes it was, kids are resilient and they're bounced back. And in fact, what we're seeing is these things are really impacting them, and they're going to carry on into later life. So.
And they bring it to school with them and to the rest.
Sure.
My kids come home and tell me stories about, you know, there's one kid who, like, sucks up all the oxygen in the room, and every single day he's down at the principal's office, and every single day he's throwing things or causing trouble. And that's distracting for the rest of the kids, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it kind of takes away from the learning environment. So,
and when you say that, what comes into my mind, I always think of what is happening in that child's life.
In that family, mm-hmm. in that home. Is that kid homeless? You know, I have a couple emails here that I'd love to share with you. And remind everybody, it's exchange@nhpr.org. You can send us an email or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 6477. Facebook or Twitter work as well. Here's an email from Robin. He says, juggling with three children on your own, what on earth were you thinking when you had three children? Your boyfriend's incarcerated, what on earth were you thinking when you took up with that doofus? Robin says, all of the programs and guidance and subsidies in the world are merely stopgap band-aids in a society that condones and supports single parenthood. Aside from an elite few of independent means, becoming an unwed mother is nearly a certain sentence of lifetime dependency and poverty. Until we end our embrace of single motherhood, we're stuck with non-viable households. Robin, thank you for the email. There's a lot here, folks, and I guess I'll turn to you first, Stephanie. I wonder what you think about his comment that, you know, the mom you talked about, yeah, she's struggling. But Robin's saying, why did she allow herself to get in that situation in the first place?
Oh, boy. I would say that no one really wants to be in that situation. I think that, I mean, I can't really speak for this mom in particular, but I mean, I think when she entered in her relationship and started having children, she probably imagined to herself that it would be a relationship that would be ongoing and that she wouldn't be in a violent relationship that ended up in her husband being incarcerated. So, you know, again, not to speak for her, but and children can be a real joy. I know that we struggle, you know, some families struggle financially, but in the end, you know, I know these three children and they're beautiful children. So I know that when I offer support, I do it for them. I mean, sometimes do adults make poor decisions? Sure. But on the other, I mean, you're doing it for the children with their best interests at heart.
So don't blame the kids, at least.
Yes. That's,
you know, I'd love your thoughts, too, on this, Ellen. And then I have another question for you, Kristen. You know, he's making a point that a lot of people make, you know, with all due respect or sympathy or whatever, people get themselves in these situations.
It's true. And it doesn't necessarily have to do with how much money you make or don't make. People make poor choices. So this could be, it's just that we don't hear about it as much when somebody has money.
Go ahead. Give us a little more on that.
Well, just that I think that there tends to be, we tend to blame poor people for being in the situations that they're in, and we make it their fault rather than that they're a product of a system that doesn't help people to climb, to see other options and to climb out of it. And the question is that all of our problem, or is it just an individual problem? I choose to see it as a societal problem. And that, as Robert Putnam has said in his book, these are all of our kids, not just one family's kids. We really need to take responsibility if we want to live in a state, in a nation that is successful.
I do wonder about the single motherhood comment. And again, Robin, thank you very much for the email. There's a lot here. He talks about an embrace of single motherhood, and certainly we have talked about, you know, single parent households struggling more for obvious reasons. What do you think, Kristen? Have we as a society embraced single motherhood?
That's a really good question, and I think that in some ways, you know, you can look at it two different ways. We have a set of supports for families that are in need, whether they're single parents or not, single mothers or single fathers. But we also have a set of supports for other members of our society that are also in need. We have supports for the elderly. We have supports for veterans. We have supports for other members of society. And so, you know, having supports for people doesn't necessarily mean that we're embracing or not embracing the situation that they're in.
Where does personal responsibility fit in for you, Ellen? As somebody who's been working for this for a long time and looked at all the trends, where does the personal responsibility element that our emailer brings up fit in for you?
I think that people have different capacities, and that some people are more able to deal with these stressful situations. We know that poverty tends to be generational. So if you're raised without the kinds of skills and understandings of how to deal with your situations. Perhaps your cognitive and emotional abilities were not fully developed because you grew up in a situation where there was toxic stress as a young child. Then oftentimes we see repeated patterns. And now the best research tells us that in order to break that cycle, we really need to be working both with the parents and with the children. And that's what's so wonderful about Kristen's home visiting program, is that you're working with both at the same time. So you're really working at changing how that family can interact differently, and those kids and the parents, because we know kids are best, if possible, with their families. And so that we want to leave them there as much as we possibly can and give them the support to change their lives.
Here's another email. This is from Carol, who says, "Don't forget that we are second in the nation for children using drugs. New Hampshire has refused to help addicts. No treatment facilities, especially for the youth, where it all begins." Carol says, "How can you say it's a great place to live in a state which chooses to spend its money in the prison system, much more costly than treatment, instead of helping people?" And I did want to talk about substance abuse and its impact on, again, the youngest kids. I wonder what you see, Stephanie, in terms of, again, your work with families. We've heard a lot about this, you know, scary opioid addiction epidemic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're certainly seeing a lot of families, you know, some very young moms, just some parents in general who are using. And oftentimes, I wonder if it's as a coping mechanism where there's just so much going on. And there is a real struggle for treatment, access to treatment, and that can be really damaging for the family and for the children who are in the home as well.
Well, that's a thing. I think I saw a headline just recently that a young mom was arrested because she and her boyfriend had been doing drugs while the toddler was in the tub. I mean, when a toddler's in the tub, you really got to pay attention. It just broke my heart to see that. So,
But really, hear families who are using, oftentimes there is some back history to that. There is some, you know, trauma or something that's happening in that individual's life. I'm not saying all the time, but certainly from some things that I've seen, that it's families are, they're struggling and they're going to drugs for coping sometimes. And when, you know, it's a dangerous world that once you enter, then it's hard to get out.
And there's an impact on the kids. Go ahead, Ellen.
And I think that the person who sent that email, I think that he or she is correct that our state has not put its money into systems to help folks around these addictions and also to ensure that they can get back on their feet. And it's true around the country, but especially here, we our mental health system definitely needs an infusion.
Well, thank you for the email, Carol. You can email us as well, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Again, email exchange@nhpr.org. Here's another email. This is from Ben. He says, "The truth is there has been no economic recovery for the average working person, despite how good CEOs and Wall Street are doing." Ben says, "To answer the question of how poverty hurts us all when we don't give every child the potential to grow, flourish, and reach their potential, we lessen the quality of our civilization." Ben says, "Second, everyone wants to live in a safer community, and poverty is the chief cause of robberies and rampant substance abuse." Ben, thank you for that email. Did you have any thoughts on that, Kristen? What do you pull out from that?
Yeah, thank you. You know, Ben is right. I mean, we really have somewhat recovered from the recession. But like Ellen said earlier, people may have jobs, but they aren't going into the jobs that they had before the recession. Wages have been stagnant, especially for men. We are only seeing sort of a little bit of wage growth, and that's principally among those who are earning at the top of the wage distribution. So the lower earning workers really aren't gaining from these jobs that are being created. And so, you know, we do see sort of the stagnant wages over the recession, in the aftermath of the recession.
Yeah, we've seen that around the country, right? It's not just New Hampshire.
It's not just New Hampshire. That's
yeah.
correct.
What's behind that, Ellen? I mean, this is I'm asking you that with 3 minutes left in the show, but
yeah.
this stagnant wage issue is a big one.
Right. And I guess I'd like to talk a little bit. We've talked about people who are in poverty, but it's really there's another measure of how to look at what people really need to live productive lives in our state, and that's the livable wage, which is an hourly rate for full-time workers that takes into account all the needs of a family. So food, childcare, health care, housing, transportation, other necessities and taxes, all the things that we've talked about today. And for every New Hampshire county, the livable wage for families is 2 to 3 times the minimum wage. So for a family of four with 2 adults and 2 kids, livable wage is about $20 an hour per adult. So now you know, this basically reflects some of the issues that have been raised today about how do we help families? Well, we have the kinds of jobs here that really provide – people want to work – that provide the incomes that these families need to support their kids.
Wow. Well, this is a whole other discussion, livable wage. I mean, $20 an hour – if everybody raised their wages to $20 an hour, what would that do for inflation and prices? I mean, that's the other side. I know that's a little outside your purview, so I'm not picking
well,
on you. But
I wasn't suggesting that this be the minimum wage for our – there's a little – what I was saying is if you take into account all of the different kinds of supports that a family needs to live successfully, that this is what it would take – to live that life, okay? And I'm not suggesting that employers pay $20 an hour. That would be great, but that was not the point of my piece of information.
Well, and here's an email from Casey who says, I've seen many single mom households in my New Hampshire town with all kinds of different circumstances. One factor that adds stress to the circumstances is their job situations. A number of these mothers work at retail and fast food establishments that require they work a wide variety of hours each week, and their schedule is not known until a day or two before the week begins. She says all this is for barely above minimum wage and never enough hours to earn benefits. Casey says, I find some employers in New Hampshire rely on the state to subsidize the lower earning workers. That's some of the stuff I think that you're talking about there. Ellen, let's take a call if we could. This is Larkin in Mount Vernon. Hi, Larkin. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. Great. Nice to meet you and whatnot. I wanted to say that I grew up in a single parent household, and referring to the email that said that we live in a society that basically encourages single parent household. My mom is a school teacher, and my dad divorced us and then just left, and she kept her married name because of the stigma of having a single parent, and she didn't want people to think that she had me out of wedlock. And thankfully we had a lot of support and whatnot, but it's kind of ridiculous and honestly a slap to the face to a lot of us that we had, because we deal with society, sorry, I'm a little nervous.
That's okay. You're doing great, Larkin. Go ahead. Yeah.
But society-wise, because there's a lot of stigma against single parents, and there's like a lot of the presenters said, of such a variety of situations, and it's just ridiculous to say that our society encourages it when it actually stigmatizes it.
Okay. Larkin, thank you very much for calling. Do you want to comment on that, Stephanie? I wonder how the people you work with feel about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that goes back to kind of what I was saying before, is I think that everyone just tries to do their best, and I think that there definitely is a stigma with certain things. I think that trying to access resources and even reaching out for help sometimes can be very stigmatizing. I don't think that families necessarily want to be in these situations. They find themselves in these situations, and I honestly feel personally that at one point in time, any of us could find ourselves in a situation where we needed to reach out and get some support.
Okay. Thank you very much, all of you, for being here. Lots more to dig into. Did you want to jump in real quick, Ellen, at the end? No? Kristen?
No, I just wanted to say Casey's got it right with the unpredictable hours and how difficult that is for single parents in the, at the low age the, with the retail and other sort of hospitality sectors.
Yeah, that would be tough for any parent, really, not knowing what your hours are week by week. How do you plan your kids' schedules, your child care, whatever you need to do. We're going to continue with this series tomorrow, looking more specifically at the issue of food and nutrition for young developing brains and bodies. But again, I want to thank everybody for coming in today. And Stephanie, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you so much.
Stephanie Emmons, Early Childhood Specialist with Child and Family Services. Ellen Feinberg, thank you for being here. I think you're going to join us tomorrow for the Nutrition Show.
I am. All right. Been a pleasure.
Ellen Feinberg, Executive Director, New Hampshire Kids Count. And Kristen Smith, good to have you. Thank you all so very much.
Thank you for inviting me.
Kristen Smith, Family Demographer with the Carsey School of Public Policy at UNH. This is The Exchange on NHPR.